You had completely forgotten about that black canvas to roll. And then, poking under the stairs, rummaging for something else, it caught your eye. You had deposited the roll there yourself, where it had lain for years, safe, but abandoned in the farthest, most inaccessible, most acutely angled corner. That nook beneath the first tread of the stairs, the section you can't get at without crawling. Yes, actually crawling on elbows and knees into that cramped cranny where darkness and cobwebs and exertion will have you burrowing and grunting, nose to the floor, posterior in the air, like a badger. But then, back once more in the kitchen, loosening the lacing, you unfurl the canvas and lay it on the table. 12 carving chisels, beech handles clunking, steel blades clanking as you unroll them. Each one is secured by a strap of broad black elastic. Immediately, it is obvious that the once whetted bevels are burred and mottled by time. At the end of the roll, there's a small orange-coloured cardboard box. Carborundum is printed in black letters on the side. Removing the lid, you inhale a faint, ancient vapour of oil. And inside the box, snug, like an archaeological artefact deposited long, long before, a silica carbide sharpening stone, 3 inches long, a slender bar of darkness. It is as light and brittle as calcified bone. These chisels belonged to my aunt, Bella, and as I oil the stone and begin the process of edging, it is as if I'm sharpening memory. With the hypnotic, circling motion, the gritty paste of the carborundum stone is whetting not just each bevel, but the rhythmic repetition is honing images from childhood as well. As a kid, I used to stay with Bella and her husband, Kieran, for a week every summer. They lived in Cork City, where Kieran was the station master. Their house was terraced, narrow, three-storey, with numerous steps up to a tall, green front door. To my child's sensibilities, there was something eerie about the place. High ceilings, echoes in empty rooms and stairwells, a vague, unsettling odour of gas, and spidery maidenhair ferns darkening each window. Bella and Kieran did not have children, and now, in retrospect, I realised that during those holidays, they spoiled me rotten. The accoutrements of their house constantly intrigued me, especially Bella's carvings. They were everywhere. My 7-year-old self tracing those marvels of mahogany, walnut, elm, plump grapes decorating press doors, fingering the head, mane, teeth and paws of the fearful lion on the fire screen, trailing Celtic designs on a bookcase, wandering and wandering through the Garden of Eden scene on the lid of a logbox. All this furniture assembled and carved by Bella herself. And then, of course, on a more mundane level, their teapot had 4 legs. Instead of tubes of toothpaste, shallow discs of a minty mush, a contraption like a bacon slicer instead of a bread knife. And at night, as I lay in bed, the gurgling of water pipes in the attic above, plus the distant shunting of trains, plumbing my restless slumbers. To this day I can see them, an odd-looking couple. She small and mercurial, decked out in her own retro creations. Bella was talkative, and her pronouncements ended invariably with a lilting Leaside falsetto. By contrast, Kieran was tall and taciturn, bespoke suits, his face pale, oval, like a Modigliani portrait. Occasionally, he'd interrupt her headlong sentences with his gentle station master metaphor. "Now, Bella, at the next switching point, leave the siding and get back onto the main line." And then, at mealtimes, after Bella had fussed and fretted about steaming everything so as to assuage her husband's peptic ulcer, the three of us sat at the table, and as if I were a changeling, they never tired of watching me, their smiles benign, a wistful benevolence in their eyes. I now have those items of furniture, the fire screen, the logbox, the press, with the clusters of grapes engraved on the doors. They are ranged around me here in the room where I write. Examining them from various angles, I can see signature impressions left on the wood by the various gouges and chisels and skews. The precision of the work so fine that no sanding was needed to finish the image, a fact which was often noted by the various judges who awarded Bella prizes over the years. As I gaze at these various objects, I can only marvel at the patience and persistence of my aunt, the strength and dexterity of the hands which wrought these perfect pieces. But I think, too, of that final scrawled letter from her, summoning me to the CIE cottage on the banks of the Lee, where Kieran and herself had spent their retirement. When I walked in, they were sitting at the kitchen table, trying to make an inventory of the various items of delf and linen and cutlery before they departed for the next instalment of life in an old folks' complex. Bella's hands were so swollen, her fingers so stiff, she could hardly tie the twine around the meagre bundles of knives and forks and spoons. That was the day I took possession of this marvellous inheritance. And now, as I sit here, light of evening streaming through the window, exactly as it did in that small cottage years ago, Patrick Kavanagh's words come to mind as I trace the chiselled lines. Naming these objects is the love act and its pledge. For we must record love's mystery without claptrap, snatch out of time the passionate transitory.